This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
Der Dezember steckt voller Gewinne mit dem Rubbellos Adventskalender. 24 mal rubbeln, 24 mal die Chance auf festliche Sofortgewinne. Mit Gesamtgewinnen von mehr als 4,5 Millionen Euro über alle Winterlose hinweg. Ich bin dann mal weg.
Rubbellose, das schnellste Glück von Lotto. Chance auf einen der Höchstgewinne, siehe Rückseite der Lose.
Across Northern Ireland, on your radio, and on BBC Sounds. This is
The Stephen Nolan Show!
So on the Nolan Show today, strikes, where are we with that? Where are the unions with that after they've met the Health Minister, Mike Nesbitt, yesterday, and the transfer test and the pressure on children? Is it a pressure that we've got to put up with because it's the way to select, or actually is it old-fashioned, out of date, and shouldn't be putting kids through that? All coming up, that and more, and Christmas Dinnergate. What type of places don't sell vegetable soup for Christmas dinner? Type of places that the Nolan team wants to go to, and I'll not be at it. All coming up this morning on the biggest show in the country.
The Stephen Nolan Show!
Good morning, everyone. Thank you for joining us today. So where are we then with this strike action that we've been hearing about in the news all week? What are we going to be facing in January and February? What are we, 6-7 weeks away from that? Are our teachers going to be out in strike? Is NI Water going to be out in strike? Is the health service going to be out in strike? And what impact would that have on waiting lists, on people who so desperately need help? And because of winter pressures, are going to need it at this time of the year, big time. Well, the unions were meeting the health minister, for example, Mike Nesbitt, yesterday. I want to get an update on where we're at with all of this. Anne Speed from Unison. Good morning, Jeanne.
Good morning, Stephen.
Good morning. So the health minister, Mike Nesbitt, he's put an offer on the table. Will it be enough to stop you striking or contemplate calling off strike action?
Well, he hasn't put a formal offer, but he's put an idea on the table that we are considering. But we put some ideas back to him. I know you don't like me talking in code, but you'll appreciate negotiations are sensitive, or discussions are sensitive. We have a possibility of getting matters over the line, but, you know, the ball's in his court now. He has to talk further with the finance minister. There is a pathway forward. We can possibly get there, but we need an extra push on this.
Give me the broad brushstrokes of what's on the table.
Well, the media have interpreted the proposal to mean, first of all, that pay parity would be implemented, but that the due date is not yet on the table, and the due date is April. So there's movement. They recognise pay parity is a big issue, has to be addressed. All the parties around the executive table seem to have come on board, so that's a good thing. There is progress here. That's the message we've been putting out to all the political parties, and they seem to have heard it.
Okay.
But there's still a gap, Stephen. There's still a gap.
So where we were at, keep me right here. So I think where we were at was Mike Nesbitt was saying, look, the executive haven't given them enough money to be able to afford to pay health service staff the same as what they're getting across the water, right? And Nesbitt said, Mr. Nesbitt, the health minister, said, I'm getting told off calling people by their last names all the time. And he basically said, look, it's the executive have done this with their eyes wide open. They haven't given me enough money. What's happening here, Anne, am I getting this right, is he can't afford it. So what he's saying is, look, we can't go back as far as April, but we can afford to go back to August, and then you'll have pay parity going forward from August. Is that it in a nutshell?
Well, that's part of it. That's part of it. The other part of it is our response, which is, look, they need to recognise the due date is April. So let's take that due date. Let's look what's in the coffers. Let's see what can be put on the table now. If there has to be a scheduling of payment, let's see what that looks like. Now, some of that conversation took place in private in a room yesterday, and I have to be very careful here, Stephen, because I'm now having a discussion where, you know, the actual membership of trade unions or the key lay leaders haven't yet heard the detail. I am due to meet my committee this morning. But I think other unions are, and we want to be respectful to those workers. Let's just say the terms of what we're discussing here is broadly the ballpark that we're in.
I absolutely get that. But it's also a conversation, not just for your members, Anne. It's a conversation, this, for all of us in the community. Because this money has to come from somewhere. And there's so many different valid arguments for where money should be assigned by this executive. So I'm sure you will agree with that. But there is a community-wide discussion as to who we back to get the money, who we do not, and our health service is at the heart of all of our lives. And nobody wants to see strike action in January or February.
Yeah, well, I think the best people empowered to make that decision will be the politicians. And if they pull collectively together, I'm reasonably confident they can find a way forward. I mean, I did listen to John Compton on your... He did participate in a discussion with us on Tuesday, I think, and he made some important points. He said savings are possible, doesn't have to mean cuts. There needs to be a rebuilding of trust between the workforce and the department and the executive. That's important. So they're all elements in the mix here of what we have to be considering. And, you know, we've elected our politicians. Hopefully they're the brightest and the smartest. They've got a whole bunch of economists to help them. I think there's a pathway forward here. They just have to pay attention to the detail.
But I guess some people...
We're not closing any doors. And our members don't want to be out in picket lines in January, February. And we don't want this to happen for, you know, the community. But, you know, if we are pushed against a wall, we will have to push back. But we're not... You know, we're hopeful. We're hopeful we can get this over the line.
But some people might think, look, you know, at the beginning of the week, you weren't getting pay parity. Mm. Now you are. Don't walk away from that. Some people, and I know this will wind you up, they might think, be grateful that you've got this offer now. Bag it for the sake of a few months. Don't insist on it being going back to April. You've got it from August. You've got it going forward now. Bag it. Bank it. Move on.
Well, the art of negotiations is to maximise the opportunity, and we're not finished yet. We're flexible, and you'll appreciate the point I made earlier. You know, I have to talk to the members of our unions who really should know the detail of all of this. Our workforce are not belligerent people. They are amenable to progress. Let's see what we can actually finally get on paper and on the table.
So what way was it left with Mike Nesbitt yesterday?
He put some propositions to us. They weren't formal offers. We discussed them. We put some responses back. He agreed to go away and have further discussion with his executive colleagues and said he would keep in close contact with us. So our door is open. We're willing to come to some kind of an agreement. Let's see what happens in the next days or hours.
One final question. Here you are doing what your job is to do to represent health workers. Do you think it would be an acceptable situation? I'm just taking this cohort of workers as one example. There are many other different examples. The police, for example, they don't have pay parity and they can't strike. So morally, do you think all public sector workers here should be getting, if they've been promised it, pay parity?
Well, each part of the public sector has its own pay arrangements. I do think there's a core issue behind all of this. And trade unions support our executive in their call for a better fiscal floor for the Northern Ireland economy. We've been disadvantaged for a number of years now. We're the poor relation. There was some movement. the fiscal floor was lifted to some extent. It needs to be lifted further. We are behind the other four, three parts of the UK. That's not acceptable. That's the kind of parity we want. Fair fiscal floor for our economy, for our society. So it's back to the UK government. They need to be listening. They need to be responding. And as regards pay, I think unions will always prefer collective bargaining, free collective bargaining for any section of the workforce to advance their interests. But our Northern Ireland executive have to be given the tools to do that. And the key tool is a better fiscal floor for Northern Ireland.
Okay. Anne Speed, thanks for giving us that update this morning. No doubt we'll talk next week again. Thank you in the meantime. 03030 80 55 55. That's Anne Speed from Unison. Starting to look like there's movement, isn't there? And essentially, will Nesbitt move to April? That's what the unions clearly want. He's saying he can afford it from August going forward. So who's going to blink in that one? Let's move on to the transfer test. Tomorrow, primary 7 children will sit the first of their school's entrance assessment group, SEAG, entrance assessment. Shows you how old I am. It was 11 plus in my day. I didn't pass it. It's the new transfer test. It's run by the principals of grammar schools in Northern Ireland. Of course, the issue of post-primary transfer by academic selection has been the focus of many debates in Northern Ireland for many, many years. The Lance MLA, Nick Matheson. Morning, Mick. Mick's not there yet. Former school principal Kathleen O'Hare is with us this morning. Morning, Kathleen.
Morning, Stephen.
Good morning. And the commentator and former DUP Special Advisor, David Graham. Good morning, David.
Morning, Stephen.
Good morning, good morning. So, Kathleen, it's you that has described the transfer test as akin to child abuse, is it?
Well, if you look at the nerves that are going right round the country at the minute with children really, you know, very highly stressed approaching this examination. I mean, they've been through 2 years of a pandemic. They've been through lots of things. And now they're being asked to decide on, you know, what they're going to do next and to go and sit two tests in a strange hall over the next fortnight. I wouldn't want to put a child through that. It is a test which is not sanctioned by the government. It is not the 11 plus that you knew in the past. It is a test which has been contrived by a number of people not to pass. There's no pass or fail in this exam. It is a quota exam. In other words, every grammar school will fill their whole quota by taking people in rank order down this test. And sometimes you can be a lottery. If you're in some parts of the country, particularly the West, you're more likely to get in with certain grades. And if you're in the Southeast, you're less likely to get in. Don't tell me that's a fair test.
But children at the age of 11, they're not wrapped up in cotton wool by the time they get to that age. They're out there in the big bad world. They're many of them could buy and sell us. They're on the internet. They're competing with each other and as human beings do in sport. They understand competitiveness and they understand that sometimes you win, sometimes you lose. Do they not?
I think, yeah, we may think that on the surface, but there's still children very much underneath. And I used to say to my sixth form, you know, you are really growing up until something happens or goes wrong, and then you go back to being children again. And I think we put too much weight on our children's shoulders. Added to the fact, Stephen, and you will not like this, I think this is a class-based exam. This is a class-based exam where you end up dividing Northern Ireland by class. You could have two schools side by side. One ends up with 10% of its cohort and free school meals, and its sister or brother school down the road has 75% free school meals.
But how does that affect the result of the test?
I don't need to tell you which is selective and which is non-selective.
But how does that affect the outcome of the test?
How does it affect the outcome of the test is about children. A lot of parents.
But whether a kid is on free school meals or not, how does that affect how they do on the day of the transfer test?
the brightest and the best of those children on free school meals will be able to get through because they have been able to do this test without tuition. Because a lot of schools are following the correct orders and not preparing children for tests. Some schools actually are, and other schools where the parents are able to provide paid tuition are able to get their children ready for this test.
So money,
that is a key thing.
So money, David Graham, your former special advisor with the DUP, money is buying those children, you know, whose parents can afford it, a heads up, a leg up. They're ahead before the two different sets of children sit down to do the same test. Does that sound fair?
No, Stephen, I have to say I strongly disagree with that. I mean, cards on the table, my own son is preparing and hopefully is prepared to do the test tomorrow and next Saturday. There is no doubt, by my own admission, it is an added stress into a household, stress for parents, stress for the child, the children. So, you know, it's not a pleasant experience. There's absolutely no doubt about that. And I've lived and breathed it. But, you know, I also have to say, even just taking myself as an example, Stephen, growing up in, you know, the west of Northern Ireland, father a farmer, mum a nurse. I mean, you know, I am quite confident, convinced that I got an opportunity in the 11 plus, which, you know, this argument about class, I totally disagree, because if we don't have selection and it's not perfect, I'm not coming on this morning saying that I'm going to die on a hill over academic selection at 11. There's an argument, Stephen, that it could be kicked through to, you know, 14, for example. But what I would say is that everyone is given an opportunity to sit this test.
But it's not the same opportunity, is it?
With a hand tied behind their back. Some people are given the opportunity with a hand tied behind their back. And we all know that as educationalists. For 35 years, I taught in non-selective schools, trying to pick up pieces from children who came in thinking they were second best to begin with. Thankfully, schools in Northern Ireland are not run that way anymore. But there is still this stigma that we hold on to the past, we hold on to an 11 plus idea, transfer idea. The past is a foreign country. They did things differently there. Other countries managed to proceed without doing this disservice to our children.
They do,
I can't blame parents.
And
I
look,
can't blame
with
children.
Respect.
I can't blame you for putting your child through the 11 plus. But I think, to be honest, in this decade, we should do
Let's
things.
Let's give David a chance.
Stephen, look, I think Stephen and I have experienced this. I am a former teacher, thus how I become a special advisor in education. And I taught in England. I taught at a school where I think now it costs nigh on £30,000 to send your child. Having done my work experience in Paul Gascoigne's former school, which was very much, you know, the other side of the tracks in terms of class. My fear is, and this is why I'm convinced that the 11 plus is the best of a bad situation. If we abolish the 11 plus, we will create a situation where we have private independent schools, which are fee paid, and we will have government schools. So selection will be still there, but instead of it being based upon academic selection, and I recognise this argument over tutors, one hand behind the back, all the rest, we will create a situation where, can your parents afford to send you? Yes, they can, regardless of your academic ability. Can your parents afford to send you? No, they can't. Well, you're going to the non-selective school because that's it, like it or lump it. So, look, we're going to have selection. We have got selection right across the UK.
It's not necessary. We don't have it.
You know, it's not in the Republic of Ireland to the any extent, and it's not in.
Well, there are private schools.
Yes, there are private schools, but
if I look, for example, at opportunities
in Northern Ireland as well. Are you telling me, David, that every non-selective school in Northern Ireland is useless and every child that goes there is useless?
Well,
because
see,
I would take real issue with that, because you're putting schools
in
hierarchy.
Hold on, he hasn't said that.
Stephen, I think you need to take a step back this morning.
Okay. Children would achieve.
All right, let's let David have an opportunity to say what's coming out of his mouth.
Yes, thank you, Stephen. I think that the contributor here is trying to put words in my mouth when actually, as I said, my father being a farmer, my mother being a nurse, this idea that, you know, friends of mine went to non-selective schools, that they were useless with respect. Some of the people I know close who didn't pass their 11 plus, who left schools with very few qualifications whatsoever, are some of the most successful people in business and other industries in this country. So I think that there's a danger here, Stephen, and you know, your contributors sadly fulfilling the stereotype, but there's a desire to say, we don't like the 11 plus, and therefore, you know, it creates this almost sort of Sodom and Gomorrah situation. I think we need to take a step back. The 11 plus is not a land of milk and honey, but nor is it a form of child abuse. As I said, my own son's going through it. Would I ideally
How much pressure? How much time? And how much pressure does it put? No, help me here, because I'm not a parent, so I don't understand. So I want you to tell me, how much of a 10-year-old preparing for that test, how much of their year is taken up with it? How much pressure is it? And is the whole focus of that year stressed out for those children? Is it or isn't it?
I think that there's no doubt, Stephen, particularly, and I blame a lot of parents for this as much as I blame schools and everything else. There is this sort of stereotype that, you know, you're judged and you'll be judged forevermore on, you know, how you do the next two Saturdays. And I think that, you know, particularly growing up in the West, we are very fortunate growing up in Belfast that there are a number of very good schools that hopefully my son has the opportunity to go to. But, you know, growing up in the West, you either went to, you know, the grammar school or the non-selective school, and basically that was sort of success or failure. And as I said, by the time you get the GCSE, there were people moving for A-level to the grammar school with some of the best results in that area, and people who were leaving grammar school with nigh on nothing. So it's not binary, Stephen. It's far from it.
I do want to get a sense from you, Kathleen, how much pressure, and parents listening this morning, 0-30-30-80-55-55. Is it the you know, age 10, and we all know childhood, the freedom you have in childhood, the joy you have in childhood, maybe you don't replicate it in adulthood as much. We want children to enjoy their childhood. How much does it take out of that year preparing for this test, Kathleen? How much pressure?
Well, I know from a lot of feeder primary schools, from being principal of large schools, that it takes a huge amount out of time. But a lot of now schools don't actually do any preparation for this transfer test because it's not seen as the test for transferring. There's another way to do that, you know, because Martin McGuinness moved towards abolishing the 11 plus in 2002. Now, there's the past for you. You know, it takes huge pressure, and I don't think we should be putting, nowadays, we should not be putting our children under that pressure, nor should we be segregating our children through class. And I met David several times. I'm not sure why he didn't remember my name and he's called me a contributor. But it is, you know, I think there's another way to do things, and it is time for a grown-up conversation on what we do and how we transfer children. There is an issue with assessment in schools. There's not enough formal government assessment in our schools. The first time we actually examine any child in Northern Ireland for something they can put down in an application form is when they're 16. And I think that is particularly sad, and that's where we're lacking in comparison to other countries that are doing really well at education. And I have to say, as chair of the Northern Ireland Skills Council, I think the skills for a workplace would be served so much better if we didn't have the segregation of schools and the segregation of class.
Nick Matheson, Alliance MLA, joining us this morning. Good morning to you, Nick.
Good morning, Stephen.
Good morning. Do you feel sorry for children, all the pressure that's heaped upon them tomorrow?
I absolutely do. I see no reason that we need to put our children through this process just to move on to the next stage of their education. We teach a common curriculum right up to age 16. So I think this is a really unnecessary mechanism that we apply. And we also, you know, assume really largely through children's primary education. But in most cases, they will attend their local primary school. Yeah, most parents don't feel the need to bus their child, you know, miles away to go to primary school. that something radically seems to change when we move to post-primary. It absolutely disadvantages, to my mind, children from less well-off backgrounds. That's entirely unnecessary. You know, teachers are quite capable of differentiating and teaching a class of mixed ability.
Are they?
Right through primary school. They do that every day from P1 to P7.
So how does it work then? Who gets what skill?
Yeah, so...
Who gets what skill?
Sorry?
So who gets what skill between primary and big school? Who decides? Yeah, how does it work?
I mean, I think it's important to note that the Department of Education's own guidance to schools around admissions criteria is very clear that it does not recommend using academic selection. So the department actually sets that out as their guidance, but yet schools routinely ignore that. There's no evidence that this is required. There's no evidence that teachers in post-primary education are incapable of offering a mixed and balanced offering to pupils of varying abilities. We have a move now where children with special educational needs are moving towards inclusion in mainstream education. And it seems to me that this whole approach of separating out based on an academic test is entirely out of step with the direction of travel in the education system globally.
Well, Kathleen and David, we'll say goodbye to you. Nick, maybe you can wait there a moment or two because there's someone wants to speak to you this morning, and we'll do that straight after the news. Sinn Féin have been in touch with us. We asked them what their view is on this. They say that they believe academic selection should be ended, and they say evidence shows that academic selection creates and enhances inequalities in our education system and should be ended. Dr. William Kitchen. Good morning, William.
Good morning, Stephen. Nick, how are you?
I'm doing okay here. I'm interested in interacting with Nick Matheson from the Alliance Party, who's been spelling out this morning just before the news how unhelpful these tests are.
I think he's patently wrong on that, and it's very interesting. Actually, one of the questions that is often asked of the opponents of academic selection is, what are the alternatives? And you've actually essentially asked him that question this morning, and indeed no answer was forthcoming, as indeed no answer is ever forthcoming.
Well, we didn't have academic selection, William, during COVID, did we? One of the years during COVID, we didn't have it, and the world didn't fall apart, and children went on with their education.
I think we probably need
to... In there, Stephen, because I didn't actually have the opportunity to answer that question. I mean, I think we could use as a starting point the department's own recommended admissions criteria would be a good starting point.
Go ahead, William.
Right. So the point about COVID is particularly interesting because you're quite right. The world didn't end. And I think talking in these extremist world views as if academic selection is a make or break decision, either for or against, is actually particularly unhelpful. We've actually heard some contributions even there this morning in the first part of the show describing it again as tantamount to child abuse, which, if we take it in the context of what we actually see in the rest of the world, there are plenty of examples of where child abuse is very easily found. To describe a test as tantamount to child abuse is absolutely and utterly disgusting. And this language is actually becoming particularly common. And we've seen this from, for example, children's commissioners, from mental health ambassadors, priests within the church and so on, describing it as barbaric. And then we wonder why children are stressed about the test whenever we've got these really powerful and influential people coming out. And they demand adult conversations, which your contributor demanded this morning, and they open by saying it's tantamount to child abuse.
Are they not stressed about the test, William, because the whole focus of their primary six and primary seven experience in school is about performing on one or two days and the what-if scenario, the pressure, if they don't?
Right. So let's unpack that narrative a little bit, Stephen, because that is an entirely reasonable question. Is there stress involved in children taking the test at this age? Absolutely. Now, I'm sitting here probably as the most ardent advocate for academic selection. I don't start the argument by being dishonest about what the test actually creates. The test undoubtedly is a pressure-filled situation. Now, we have a decision then as the adult community as to what way we actually respond to that stressful situation. Do we heighten that stress, or do we try to mitigate and reduce that stress? I think what we get very often is we get adult contributors, like we've heard even this morning, saying that it's tantamount to child abuse, and too often use the stressful situation to push their ideology onto people to try and use this as a situation to try and get rid of the test. Now, let's then unpack what it is what children are actually doing when they do the test. We've heard this morning as well from all of the opponents of academic selection that going to a secondary school, a non-selective school, is not a disadvantage. We've heard that. We've actually heard Nick there himself say that teachers in secondary schools are more than capable of teaching a differentiated curriculum. I'm not quite sure that Nick knows what that means, but he has ruled that phrase out anyway. A differentiated curriculum.
Well,
I'm making that argument.
Yeah,
Stephen,
but I think we've got to let Nick respond to this.
Well, he will. But
let him respond now. Then we'll move on to the next point.
Yeah, I mean, I think apologies. The line was quite poor there for some of the contribution there. I mean, I don't really understand why we make a difference between what we do at primary school level and what we do at post-primary. That to me is where, you know, we suddenly decide that we have to find some method by sorting based on alleged ability.
I can explain that
at age 11. I'm not really asking for an explanation. I'm making the point that I don't believe it is necessary. There are negative consequences that arise from this. To give an example, data from 2019 to 2020 would say that in a non-selective school in Northern Ireland, 37% of the pupils would have been on preschool meals, and in a selective, only 13%. Now, if that isn't social segregation, I don't know what is, and I just do not see how that is desirable for our education system.
I can explain that. I'm quite happy to explain that. So you don't understand how that's desirable. I'll give you a very simple explanation of that. At some point in the...
It cannot be desirable that we socially segregate our children
You're describing that as social segregation. What I would describe that as is an identification of an aspect of education, which then, so, and particularly in the comprehensive sector or in the non-selective sector, if that sector has disproportionately more children within it who come from a free school meals background, what we should then do is use the identification of that problem to support those children to get the education that they need. So the reason why academic selection is actually desirable is because it identifies children who actually require more support from the education system, and we can then start to invest in the children who need that. So one of the myths that comes with the academic selection discussion is that it is used to skim off the top and simply push these children who are academically bright forward towards advantageous educational
let's
outcomes.
Let's see what we think at home this morning as well. Jane and Lauren. Morning, Jane. Good morning. Jane's fallen asleep. David and Ballywalter. Morning, David.
Good morning.
Go ahead.
First of all, is the argument here selection or non-selection? Because I think, regardless of what happens, there will be selection. Now, there may be academic selection, or it might be selection from some other source, such as the amount of money your parents can afford to send you to particular schools. And secondly, this selection exam that's coming up tomorrow, it's not compulsory. If you don't want your child to sit it, they don't have to do it. So the parents are putting the children under pressure to start with.
David, thank you. Let's try Jane again. Morning, Jane.
Hi, Stephen. Stephen, I think the 11 plus is tied around a lot of snobbery, quite honestly. I mean, parents seem to think that if they get the 11 plus, they're going to be geniuses for the rest of their life. Everything's going to be sailing, which is not the case. There's a lot of children out there that have, let's say, a difficulty like dyslexia and things like that, and there isn't the money put into supporting these children. So where do those children go who generally turn out, if they get the right support, to be absolute geniuses, smarter than probably the teachers that's teaching them? But if they are needing an assessment, do you know much an assessment costs? £600 to be assessed by a clinical psychologist. That's hardly right.
To be assessed for what?
For being dyslexic.
That's a private assessment you're talking about, isn't it?
The school only has a certain amount of finances to get all these children assessed that they reckon the teachers can see that there's an issue. This problem has only been recently addressed. Well, actually, David Dunseith was the first person to address this in the teacher training colleges, children with learning difficulties. And a lot of these kids are really smart. And how do you think they feel whenever, you know, they are seen as failures? You know, and if they don't do the preparation for the 11 plus in the classroom, they're set to the side and they're not getting the prep for the next level of education.
Jane, thank you. We'll say thank you, Nick Matheson, Dr. William Kitchen this morning as well. Alex in Lisburn. Morning, Alex.
Morning. No, I'd just like to say from you, that last call actually but raised the point about paying for private assessments. I remember in the past, just because you pay for a private assessment doesn't necessarily mean it's going to be accepted by the education authority. They'll often want to do their own assessment. But in terms of academic selection, you know, in most non-grammar schools, they'll grade their children. The first thing they'll do, in my experience, is they'll set a test and they'll be graded that way, whereas at the grammar school, they're graded by the alphabet.
What about the pressure on the kids on the day? Is it acceptable?
Well, that's coming from the parents.
But is it acceptable?
No, it's not. But it's coming from the parents.
Is it not just life that you cannot protect children from winning, losing, competitiveness, getting what they want, not getting what they want? You know, society does as much as possible to reassure these children that it's not failure. But is it to them failure? Does it feel to them like failure?
You're probably right, Steve. But many years ago at primary school, I can remember a few of my class, if they got a spelling wrong, they were crying. They burst into tears, they got a spelling wrong. Pressure's come from the parents.
In my day up at Spring Hill Primary School, fantastic school, up at the top of the Ballygamartin Road. So on all the kind of prep tests in P6 and P7, I was lucky enough, I don't know why, I loved that school. I absolutely adored Spring Hill. I was getting 100 out of 100, right? And they were actually taking a mark off me just to make sure I didn't get big-headed. And the reason I'm telling you this is not the boast. It's the context. So I was getting 100 out of 100 in all of the prep tests for the 11 plus, as it was. That was the transfer test. And then I went in on the day to do the 11 plus, the transfer test. And whatever happened, I lost it. I just, the pressure got to me. And so on that one day, I didn't get 100 out of 100. In fact, I fell apart so much that what I got was the middle grade. There was an A grade, which was pass. There was a G grade, which was fail. And there was an M grade, which was the middle grade. And I got the middle grade. And the only reason I got in the INST was the principal of Spring Hill at the time was a guy called Ronnie Lamont. Ronnie was on the Board of Governors of INST. And he persuaded them that I should go down and do an interview for them to contemplate me as a pupil there. And the sense of failure that I had letting down my parents has stayed with me to this day, of back there, age 11. Now, it worked out for me all right in the end, Alex. I guess all I'm trying to add to this discussion is one day you can fall apart.
But what's the alternative, Stephen? The alternative, if you don't want to have selection, is you put all the pupils, regardless of their abilities, in the one class. And then the teacher either has to teach different pupils at different rates, or the brightest pupil has to be taught at the rate of the less academically gifted per child can pick up the lessons. And they say, like, maths. I was never good at maths. But the person who's really good at maths, are they going to be held back until I catch up, basically? And that's the reality. And I don't know how you get away from that.
And Catherine in Belfast, your son is doing the test on Saturday.
Yes, he is. It's been awful. It's been a really awful process. We're not pushy parents, so there's been a lot of talk of parents putting pressure on their children. We're not pushy parents at all. We haven't really done anything until the past couple of months. And we're really only sitting it because it's just to give them an extra chance of getting into a local school, because there's so much competition for places in local schools in South Belfast, and there's just not enough. There's children going unplaced. There's children having to travel large distances or else through town in the traffic to go to other parts of Belfast. So this was really just a way for us to give them another option of going somewhere local. It's not something we have chosen.
How much has his... I'm trying to ask this in an open way. Has his childhood been affected significantly, P6, P7, because of the pressure of the test?
I would say yes. In the past few months, it has. It's not the life he would be living if he wasn't doing the transfer test. And his school is quite laid back. A lot of the children don't sit it. It's actually an Irish medium school, so a lot of them go on to the Irish secondary. but it's just not close enough to us, and it's far, you know, it's through traffic. So we're looking at somewhere local. So he would be living a different life if he didn't have to do the transfer test.
There are some schools where the children have been doing two tests a week for months.
Yeah.
Two practice tests a week for months. Catherine, thank you. John in Belfast. Thanks. Morning, John.
Morning, Stephen. Stephen, the elephant in the room, I think it is a class-based system. I drive up and down the Lisburn Road to work most days, and I see very, very few kids from Sandy Road crossing the road to go to Methody. I see hundreds getting the train in from Hollywood, Bangor, Lisburn, those sorts of places. And I think it's a cruel exam. It's the one exam in life you cannot repeat. You can repeat every other exam. You fail an O-level or a GCSE, you can go back and you can do it again. The 11-plus brands you have failure 10 years of age, you can't go back. You can't change it. You can't repeat it.
But why are you branded a failure if you go to secondary school?
Well, no, you're not branded. You're in the kid's head. You hear secondary school teachers say it takes them a year to build the esteem up of some of their pupils again. You know, and I think it's very, very interesting to hear, you know, a DUP, an ex-DUP SPAD on defending the 11-plus. And then, you know, at the other side of the DUP, they're wondering why, you know, there's a real underachievement in Protestant boys from working class areas. And I think the 11-plus has a lot to do with that. And the fact that they can't see that, for me, says quite a bit about them as a party.
So if you hold off, well, first of all, David Graham is speaking in his own right.
Yes, but he was advising them. I'm making a point, you know.
Yeah, so David's not speaking on behalf of the DUP. We did ask the DUP to come on. They haven't put anyone on. They say they want to talk about bread and butter issues, and yet, you know, they're not here to talk to you about this bread and butter issue. That's for them.
But
John, if you're protecting children aged 11 from that type of test, then it's 14, 15 when you come to GCSE level. Is that also off the cards? Is that cruel?
No, it's not, because as I said earlier, Stephen, kids all develop at different ages. I went to a school where, you know, people repeated their GCSEs. They were allowed back to repeat GCSEs. They were given a second chance, and they took it. As I say, the 11-plus, you can't repeat it. It's a one exam. It is pure snobbery. I mean, my kids all did. The 11-plus, I took part in that system. Because I took part in it doesn't mean I agree with it. And there's a lot of talk about what's the alternative. I mean, the conversation this morning has nearly ignored the fact. It's nearly as if some of our secondary schools aren't producing kids that are becoming doctors, solicitors, and you know, going to university and all the rest of it. You know, I've heard all the callers saying, what's the alternative? The alternative is there in black and white. We have hundreds of good secondary schools that are turning out kids into academia, into the workforce, into whatever, you know, whatever skill suite they have. It's not rocket science. You know, I heard people talk about, are they all thrown into the one class? No, they're not. They're screened within their secondary school, and within their school life, they can move up and down those bands depending on where they are at that particular time. You know, I think 10 years of age is far too young to be sort of making that decision on kids.
Can you not flip that the other side, though, John, and say, look, whether you support the test or not, it's not life-defining. It might feel like that to that young person at that stage, but, you know, with experience, as you grow up, you understand that actually there are many different paths in life and it doesn't define you. It might feel like that, but is that feeling transient?
You could be right, but why put them through it? Why do it? There are alternatives. You know, our education system isn't the best. You know, you look at, there's models in Finland and those Slavic countries that don't do any of this testing, and their results are fantastic. Mine's better than us.
John, thank you. Gary, next morning, Gary.
Good morning, Stephen. How are you?
Go ahead.
No, I just want to say my experience. First of all, the 11-plus, the selection isn't perfect, okay? But for me, I grew up in a housing estate, council house, came from working class background. I got the chance, I passed my 11-plus, I got a chance to go to a grammar school in Lisburn. Now, no matter how it's looked at now, if people ask me now, what school do you go to, and I tell them, they look at me slightly different, they go, oh, fair play. My sister worked her way up, as I say, working class background. She's now in a top banking job in Edinburgh. So the system over there, if we were going to copy the system in Edinburgh, her children both go to a private school in Edinburgh. She pays over £2,500 a month.
A month?
For the equivalent of a grammar school education.
£2,500 a month? Are you sure?
For two children. This is in Edinburgh.
Is she loaded?
Oh, she's done all right. A lot better off than me. But the system over there is where she lives, they are told to go to your local school. The local school there, it's just local comprehensive school. It's underachieving. It's falling apart. So her option was to sell up and move to a much more affluent area where the property would probably cost twice the amount and then go to a local school or pay for a private education. Now, her boss recently moved over from Belfast, and I think his two children went to a grammar school in Belfast, and he was shocked at the amount of money he had to pay. So what I'm trying to say is, we're getting this chance, the 11 plus, or the chance, as I call it, as you call it, it's not perfect. But if somebody from a working class background gets that chance and gets into a school and gets that extra little kick up, well then why not?
Well, the reason, Gary, why not might be that you've said that extra little kick up. So what about that boy or girl that is in the secondary school who doesn't feel like they have that extra kick up and therefore is on the back foot? And they are as smart as the middle class kid, but they didn't have a tutor. And their mum and dad are as good as the middle class parents, but they don't have enough money to get a tutor. And they're on the back foot.
I don't have a tutor.
Yeah, but for some kids it is the difference, isn't it?
Yeah.
That's why the middle class parents are buying the tutors, because it makes a difference.
Well, the school I went to, there was kids in first year who were paid into first year because they went to the prep school. And then maybe they didn't meet the standards and they dropped out and went to secondary schools in the second year. But equally, I can see your point. See, in Lisburn, there's a school called Lisnagarvey, which for years had a notorious reputation. See, now there's kids leaving sixth year there and going to Queen's to do law degrees. So things have changed from I went to school. Things have changed from you went to school. Yeah. My father came from Woodville. Passed his 11 plus, wanted to go to BRA. His mother said, you'd have to get two buses to go to school. Just go to Ballygamorton High and you'll get a job with your dad in the shipyard. That mentality, I think, still exists all these generations later. And that's the problem. It's only now that I'm involved with the community sector in Lisburn. And it's only now you see parents making more of an effort. But that mentality still exists. That's the problem we have.
I'll share something with you. And look, this is not in support or indeed against the 11 plus. It's just me sharing something with you about me, right? The impact on me of not succeeding as I was predicted to do in that 11 plus, all right? It's really interesting. I'm sure a psychologist would have a field day. Is I'm 51 now. So this is 40 years later. There is still something in my mind that no matter how positive something is looking, no matter how likely something is that it's going to go my way, there's something in my mind, Gary, that harks back to that 11-year-old kid that actually, no matter what the predictions are, it's not going to happen. Now, I don't know if it's linked to that or not. I wonder. I don't know.
But maybe it gives you that extra drive to succeed.
Well, Ince gave me the...
Yeah.
I have absolutely no doubt Ince was a life-defining moment for me, walking into that school, seeing all these rich kids among me, and I wasn't one. And I just reacted by saying, stuff you, I'm as good as you, but it was life-defining for me.
Did you ever read any books by Jeffrey Beattie?
No.
He's a psychologist. I've
interviewed Jeffrey. I remember my dad going down, parking a ladder, dropping me off in a ladder. Do you remember a ladder car?
Mm-hmm.
Outside the gates of Inst when lots of the other kids were down in their mics and their BMWs and all of that. Anyway, Gary, thank you. Martin and Bangor. Morning, Martin.
Good morning.
Morning. Go ahead.
We have to have a process by which we can give the gifted the opportunity to succeed.
But aren't all children gifted?
Yes, but not all in the same ways. But we must also provide a system whereby every child of all gifts are given a good education. But that's not necessarily happening. And by the way, I agree with you 100% on the comment you made a little bit earlier. Life's not fair. And we should teach our children early that life isn't fair.
Well, or we should try to make it as fair as possible, as early as possible.
We should strive to, but it's never going to be absolutely fair.
Art next. Morning, Art.
Morning, Stephen. How are you doing?
Doing all right.
Good to talk to you again.
It's an interesting conversation, isn't it?
I'm a dairyman, but I've been down the south.
We'll not hold that against you.
That's good. there are a lot of things about dairy and about my education that I'm very proud of, because I went to college and I was taught by John Hume, and I was taught by many, many other good teachers. I got my grounding in the two subjects I did for my degree from a great French teacher and a great Irish teacher in St. Columb's, and great literary foundation and everything else. But I moved down south, went to university down south, and then I ended up teaching down south. And I've been teaching down south all my teaching life. And never have I been dealing with an entrance examination. There were some entrance examinations years back for, say, certain schools. But now they've all gone now, and it's a very egalitarian system. And the only thing I don't like about the Leaving Cert system down south now is that you have to do maths right up until the day you leave school. I would have hated that, you know.
Art, thank you, sir. We'll leave it there. Patrick in Belfast, we'll squeeze you in before the news at 10. Morning, Patrick.
Good morning, Stephen.
Morning.
Stephen, just it was a fellow was on there earlier on, and he says about you get one opportunity at the transfer test. Well, I know people who have went and started like a comprehensive school year 8, and then done the comprehensive test from there, done the transfer test from there, which, if they passed, they started year 9 within a grammar school. So there is a second opportunity there for people who didn't make the grade the first time.
Yeah, you can swap between schools, can't you? Patrick, thank you. Laird, final call before the news. Morning, Laird.
Yeah, it's, you know what, Stephen, we need to look at how good our education system is and advance on it, not try and change it. I was educated, not trying to change it too much. I was educated here. My children were educated in North America. Complete different systems, and don't even think of going that way.
Well, why not?
Well, when you actually go through that system, ours is much more specific. That 11 plus is absolutely really good because it splits the academic from not so much like what I was.
Does it?
And it does.
Or is it a test on one day?
On one day. And I would actually
but it's just a test on one day, isn't it?
Yeah, well, and I feel that.
Imagine if you were doing your driving test, and based on that one driving test, you're defined for the next 5 years as to what car you can drive.
Two different things, Stephen. You need to stay on the school in here and turn around and go.
But we say to children, one test, that's it.
Yeah.
Why aren't we saying to children, one test, and you can do it? You can do it again.
Well, actually, when I was there at the secondary school, if you were that good, you could go back into the grammar school.
Okay. Laird, thank you very much. Morning to you. 030-30-80-55-55. Interesting chat today with you all. We're going to look at bonfires next after the 10 o'clock news. And then the sexiest man. How is finding the sexiest man and not the sexiest woman not sexist? All coming up. Sometimes I'm surrounded, quite often I'm surrounded, with madness in the Nolan team. And I often sometimes think I'm the only sane person in the whole team of the Nolan Empire in the BBC. And so I find myself, by the way, people will hate me saying that empire. Let me tell you, I'm a little player in that empire because I'm being overwhelmed with madness about our Nolan Show Christmas party, where the absolute... These people are on something where they cannot find anywhere in Northern Ireland for a Christmas party, and I kid you not, I'm refusing to go, which does vegetable soup, they claim. So the next of it is now that the next place that they have defined as a possible venue for the Nolan Show Christmas party, wait for this, does beetroot. beetroot soup for Christmas dinner. Now, these people are mad. They have clearly swallowed some type of BBC juice when they come in every morning. The Director General, Tim Davey, was here yesterday and they all come in white training shoes. They're just like, what is going on within this Nolan team? And so now, having, what is going on? So can some of you help me find somewhere in Belfast? Because no, I'm not going outside of Belfast from a Christmas dinner. Can any of you actually share with me somewhere which does vegetable soup? Like, it's crazy. And also, I don't want a little bit of turkey and ham, which is the size of my wee baby finger or my wee baby toe. I don't want it. I want a big slap of turkey and a big slap of ham that is bigger than my whole hand. So maybe you could help me this morning, please, against these people who the BBC have given me to surround me with help and assistance. 030 30 80 55 55. Apparently some of the Nolan team are wanting on air now to fight back. We'll see if we've time for that before the end of the programme. Now, next, an 11th night bonfire this year, costing ratepayers, according to councillor, Alliance Councillor Michael Long, who we'll hear from in a moment, over 20 grand. He says it's led to a 3G pitch in East Belfast being closed for the past 6 months. Belfast Telegraph is reporting the damage from the Clonduff bonfire on council-owned land at Lisnashara Leisure Centre has been closed for health and safety reasons and waiting repair. I've been speaking to the loyalist activist Muir Holmes and asked him how this cost can be justified.
Well, I don't think you're having to spend tens of thousands of pounds because of a bonfire. I think we've had some challenges at various sites throughout a number of years. That's not something that's exclusive to Clonduff, and it's not something that's exclusive to bonfires with our young people. There can sometimes be challenges, and I think the answer to that is to deal with it in an appropriate, mature and responsible way. I mean, what we've witnessed in Clonduff over the past number of months, probably since this incident in May, is a litany of ongoing positive work. In Clonduff itself, you have the community centre there that has been doing some fantastic work with the young people who build the bonfire. The police have been in attendance working with the young people, engaging with the young people. There has been a cultural programme that began at the end of May in response to this incident that took place, which was exploring young people's cultural rights, Stephen, but also their cultural responsibilities. We spoke about, you know, property and antisocial behaviour and all these sorts of things. These young people as well are ongoing with current OCN qualifications. They attended City Hall recently. There's been lots of positive work.
Well,
work with these young people, to engage with them and to put them on a positive...
Lots, you know, of sugar coating there, Muir Holmes. The bottom line is 150 grand of public money was spent on a new pitch for the community. 150 grand. And what happens? An 11th night bonfire means that the pitch can't be used. The pitch is destroyed to an extent where £20,000 has had to be used to fix it again. And we can't keep a bonfire away from a pitch. The pitch closed for the past 6 months.
Well,
like, it's just nuts, isn't it? It's mad.
I think we'd need to have a little bit of like scrutiny over those exact figures. I'm not entirely sure all of that is accurate. But what I'm not going to allow for is this constant demonization, not just of that community, but of those young people.
It's not that sensible.
We're not entirely sure who was involved in that incident or how it came about. My understanding is that there's a strain in relationships with people within the centre and all this sorts of things. But what I would say is that you have two pitches in that area. One is closer to the bonfire than the one that is closed, and it is used every single night. So to portray this as if these young people are damaging everything within their proximity, it's just completely untrue. There was an incident with some broken glass. That broken glass causes issues for the pitch. And unfortunately, of course, nobody wants to see that sort of thing. Unfortunately, you know, it costs to repair that, but it's not like everything's being wrecked within this proximity. There's been lots of positive work with these young people. They are fantastic
young people, good young people within that estate. You have a fantastic cultural celebration. These are the same young people, might I add, Stephen, that were pouring cups of tea and coffee and handing out biscuits for the elderly at various community fun days in Clonmel. These are the same young people that hosted a remembrance event where they showed a movie for people within the community about World War One. These are great young people, and what we really need is not this megaphone diplomacy over the media where we demonise and where we degrade and where we paint these people out to be the worst in the world. What we need is proper engagement and dialogue. Look what's happened with that good engagement and dialogue over the last number of months.
Well,
positive work. We don't need Michael Long spouting sound bites on the media.
Well, Michael Long is an Alliance councillor. You say he's spouting sound bites. He's representing those people who no doubt think it is insane that a council which could be using money on those very young people you talk about, educating them, investing in them, that they're spending £12,000 a year on fire retardant material for that pitch. Why? Because there's a bonfire built beside it.
Again, I think we really need to scrutinise those figures. It is my understanding that the retardant material was purchased 2 years ago and we're able to reuse it year on year. That might be changing this year. I don't know. But again, I think there needs to be some scrutiny over those figures. I think the real challenge here is for us to engage. It's easy to run to the media and paint people and communities and bonfire builders as the worst in the world because you highlight and focus in on one specific issue. What is needed is proper dialogue and a genuine willingness to engage with what are a fantastic group of young people who are doing fantastic work.
Well, look, let's have that engagement, some of it now with you. What could be done next year, this July coming, to try for the young people to take the initiative, for people like you to take the initiative and protect a community pitch? What could be done?
This is exactly, Stephen, I mean, there are things that are already being done that need to be recognised. I mean, it's sometimes a gripe of mine how quick certain councillors and people are to report the negatives, but they turn a blind eye to many of the positives that are ongoing. There was this incident in May. Okay. In June, at the end of May, all this positive work, really took off. There was a cultural program, like I've mentioned to you before, highlighting and exploring some of the issues that can be around bonfires, but also promoting the positive essence of the bonfire culture, which is to be celebrated by everyone. The police were doing positive work with these young people. There is now ongoing throughout the year OCNs being completed and qualifications for these young people. Like I said to you, they were recently on a tour of Belfast City Hall. There's lots of people who are invested in the same.
How old are these young people?
There are lots of people who are invested in seeing positive outcomes and having a positive expression of a fantastic culture, and that's where we're getting to. And of course, there is positive messaging around protecting, facilities and property and nearby, and I'm making sure that it is a safe and welcoming cultural expression. I think, where there were some negative headlines, and regretfully this is another one, but there were some negative headlines a year or so ago about Clonmel, we're really in a much better place. And the credit goes to those young people themselves.
How old are they, Mayor?
Well, look, there's a whole variety of, like any bonfire, Stephen, there's no magic number.
But these young people involved in these initiatives you're talking about, how young do they go? How old do they go? What's the spread?
Like anyone who knows, bonfires and the people that build bonfires, it's a range of young people from the age of 13 up to 18. Which is great. I mean, there aren't many things out there that bring young people together across different ages like that in a positive way, and the bonfire culture is certainly one of them.
Well, that was to be one of my questions.
Clonduff is attended and supported by over 1,000 people from within the estate.
Do they use the pitch?
Sorry?
Do they use the pitch?
Well, like I said to you, Stephen, there are two pitches adjacent or within the proximity there of that site. The closer pitch to the bonfire, which isn't damaged, by the way, and the fire retardant material goes on, and there's no risk of it being damaged because the young people have reduced the height year after year to ensure that it doesn't pose any serious threat to property. There's a pitch there that is used every single night of the week. But there's another pitch within the Lisnashara complex And that's the one where there was regretfully this one incident that caused it to be closed. Now, I don't know why it's taken so long for the repairs to take place. Maybe that's a bureaucratic process. I don't know. But we're now at a place where, yes, I think everyone's supportive of the pitch. Everyone wants it to be used. And regretfully, that incident took place. But now we're in a place where it can be fixed and people can move on.
OK. Mir, thanks for talking to us this morning. Appreciate it. Thanks very much.
Thanks, Steve. Bye.
Well, listening to that, the Lands Councillor, Michael Long. Good morning, Michael.
Good morning. How are you?
Well, I'm doing OK, thank you. And every time Mir Holmes was talking about a councillor and people winding it up and all of that, he was talking about you.
Yeah, well, you were talking about madness earlier on, and I think most people would find that this is madness, that we have a £20 million facility in the local community. We have excellent facilities provided in terms of football pitch. And, you know, as somebody who is a councillor in East Belfast, I know just how precious it is to have one of those facilities nearby. And I was contacted by local residents who wanted to use the pitch and haven't been able to do so for the last 6 months. And the reason they haven't been able to do so is because there's glass on the pitch. And that has meant that it has not been able to be used for this period of time. I'm talking about a one-off issue. Of course, two years ago, it was also damaged in terms of being set on fire, the pitch, in terms of that issue. So this is not a one-off problem.
Well, glass on a pitch, Michael, you cannot link to what Mir Holmes would describe as a cultural expression through bonfire building.
Oh, like, you can actually.
Anybody can throw glass on a pitch. Bonfire.
No, but it's the people, and it was quite clear, and Mir didn't actually stand back to that and say anything else, because it was the people who were involved in and around the bonfire who threw the glass onto that and was broken. There was a number of other antisocial behaviour issues around people throwing stones, apparently at people on the pitch at some points as well. There's been a number of major issues, and it is directly linked to the bonfire, as it was 2 years ago.
But if there's trouble at a football match, you don't suggest banning football matches. Where are you going for this? Are you trying to get bonfire building stopped?
No, absolutely not. So what I would say is, and what was the original plan whenever this centre was open, was we have two fantastic 3G pitches, but there are space for a bonfire to happen at that location. So I'm not saying that it shouldn't be a bonfire. Indeed, I was at a community meeting about the new leisure centre at the time. It was quite clear the community wanted to have that. I have no interest whatsoever in them people not having a bonfire. What I'm happy to see, though, is a bonfire that is of certain heights and a certain opportunities to avoid guidelines being broken, which means that people can have that, but the local issues and the local pitches are not damaged. So we don't need to spend £14,000 a year on fire materials. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, you can say every year £14,000, and that includes the erection and removal of the material, is being spent on this. Which is absolute madness in a position where we currently are financially, where we're in a cost of living crisis, and we're spending money on this. It's madness, and particularly to do with the glass that's on there. The reason why it's taken so long to do is because it has got into the crumb of the local, of the pitch itself, and it has to be removed with some big industrial vacuum cleaner, which is not easy to sort of access, and it's cost £4,500. So the pitch has also been closed, and the other figures we're looking at is because it can't be rented, and it's usually rented obviously on a very regular basis, their council are also losing income of about £6,000 a year. So in fact, the figure that I have, because I don't think that it includes the amount of money that's going to take to redo the crumb of the pitch, is actually a very conservative figure. But it is interesting that Mir also highlighted the fact that there's no risk of any damage to the other pitch. So the people who are involved in the bonfire can be quite happily and quite capable of making sure that the bonfire is not going to damage the other pitch. And yet, twice in the last 3 years, it has been out of action for about 6 months. And local people, local people have contacted me. They want to be able to use the pitch. Some people, they've had to go and use other places which aren't as convenient. And some of the players aren't even able to go along because of transport issues and whatever. So this is having a really negative impact in a local community. And I'm not looking to demonize young people, I'm quite clear that this whole issue is orchestrated by gatekeepers in the local community, and they're quite happy to use young people in terms of that. I've seen it myself in terms of other issues with this bonfire, in terms of posters of myself that were burnt in large numbers last year because I dared to
You were put on the bonfire, were you?
Yeah. There was at least 10, 12 posters of mine that were there. And obviously the other issue that I had was that I was physically assaulted not far from that area. And the people who spoke to me raised the issue of me having an opinion on terms of the bonfire. So
assaulted in what way? Sorry, I don't know about this. What did they do to you?
Well, I was walking along the road and two people came up to me and they told me that I was to go away, to leave the area, that I wasn't welcome in the area. I was leafleting for the council elections in 2023. And at that point, I said, no, I'm going on here. They stood in my way. They took the leaflets that I had, they threw them around and told me to get out or else. So that's the kind of issue that I'm more concerned about. I'm not trying to demonize. I'm not trying to demonize young people, but I do have concerns that there are some gatekeepers in that community who are determined to dictate what everybody else does. I work very hard in Clonduff and right across my area. I deal with local issues on a regular basis from people who come to me from Clonduff and indeed all around Listenshire. I don't at any time have any issues with dealing with the vast majority of people who really don't want this kind of thing. They don't want antisocial behaviour going on from March. They don't want to have stones being thrown. They don't want to have glass bottles and being disturbed in the middle of the night. They don't want that kind of thing happening. And, you know, I'm happy as myself, okay, and I won't be intimidated. I'm happy to go out and actually say, you know, this needs to be dealt with.
Michael, thank you very much indeed for speaking to us this morning. Thank you. It's 22 minutes past 10.
It's beginning to look a lot like Christmas everywhere you go.
Da-da-da-da-da.
Take a look at the 5 and 10. It's glistening once again with candy canes and silver lanes that glow.
There's quite a significant row going on in the Nolan show, which could bring the whole house down. This move, this BBC move for the Nolan show into the newsroom could be called off over Soupgate, Partygate. Peter Cinnamon, who is part of the Nolan team, is in front of me here very shortly to be moved to Evening Extra or something, if I get my way with it.
Well,
over the very fact that you can't find anyone or anywhere that will deliver vegetable soup for our Christmas party. You don't deserve to be in the Nolan team.
I thought this job would be simple and easy. Go find a place for the Christmas do, somewhere nice, turkey and ham. That's what we were looking for. And all of a sudden, we've been
looking
stopped
for,
by you.
Looking,
by you.
Looking for.
We've had so many beautiful options talking about...
That's right, parsnip soup.
Lovely selections. Belfast has amazing restaurants, and we have our pick of them.
What type of amazing restaurants don't give the option of vegetable soup and turkey and ham?
Stephen, we have been held back. You're the blockage.
Yes,
to block
I absolutely
our
am.
Big Christmas.
I'm not going.
All over a vegetable soup.
I'm not going. If there's no vegetable soup, I'm not going. If these places think that they can give you a little dollop, a little cumin soup. Like, what? I don't even know what cumin soup is.
Some people.
Nor do I care.
Adore a little nice cumin soup. In fact, all of a sudden, vegetable broth is important. Last time I checked.
I can imagine. Listen, you're clearly, it's like football, isn't it? It's
yes.
Like the transfer window. So Good Morning Ulster and Talkback and Evening Extra will be bidding for some of the Nolan team. We're going to put you on a free transfer. Because there's absolutely no way. Like, Declan Harvey would love cumin soup at Christmas. I can tell right now that man would be disgusted at the thought of vegetable soup.
This is a man who is open to many different culinary delights. Stephen, you need to broaden your horizons.
No.
This is maybe a part of it here.
Just make you sick.
We're going to bring you out.
I
let you try something
here.
New and different.
Someone has sent to me, and this is no wind-up, right? So we're sitting currently, what date is it? It's the 15th of November. We have nowhere to go for our Christmas party.
We have had places that were on the horizon.
And last year we didn't have enough seats booked, so we had to sit on each other's knees, which was a whole other front page story in itself.
Which is why I've taken over.
Right. And this year now, we don't have anywhere booked because you are booking these posh, crazy places. Now, Mary and Dunmurry, will you back me up here? Good morning.
Good morning, Stephen. Yeah, I heard your request for somebody to ring in about good Christmas dinner.
It's crazy. Mary, do you know the point we're at? David Lennox has posted to me in the last few minutes a menu. And it says fresh vegetable soup for starter. It says traditional roast turkey and ham. Look at that. You even get vol-au-vents. And you get...
Vol-au-vents, Stephen.
Vol-au-vents. And you get Christmas pudding or profiteroles. Guess where? The city hospital. So I'm actually going to go, even the city hospital. If you're in hospital, you get vegetable soup and turkey and ham.
I know the listeners out there sympathise with the team having to work with you every day, Stephen. But we were all excited to pick a great restaurant. And you have been... Imagine you trying to book the Christmas do and there's one person that
I'm not
says,
going.
Oh, no. You say that's a negative thing for some of us. We get to have a nice night out. A bit of peace for an evening out.
You can. Mary, help me here.
Yeah, well, Stephen, yeah, I appreciate your concern about the soup because I like vegetable soup too.
Yes.
And I can recommend the Beach Lounge Hotel in Dunmurry at the Crossroads.
Ah.
And last year we had an excellent
there you go.
Dinner.
You see, Mary, you see what happens to them. They come in here to the BBC. They clearly get, you know, with their special terms and conditions. They get molly, what's the term? Mollycoddled?
Mollycoddled, is that what you're saying?
Mollycoddled, whatever it is. That's what happens to you all. And you lose the plot. You absolutely lose the plot. You can tell. What do you call that wee man that does the weather? I bet you he's in your crowd too.
Our best.
Jeff Maskell. Oh. I bet you he likes parsnip soup. You can spot these people a mile off. Every one of you, Maskell, Harvey, you can spot them a mile off.
Everybody has a moaner in the office.
Graham in Belfast. Good morning, Graham.
Nolan.
Good morning, Stephen.
Good morning.
Stephen, just a quick recommendation. Go to Binky's on the Belmont Road and they will do you the best turkey and ham and a good portion of it at a good affordable price.
Are you with me that there's something wrong with the place if they're not at least offering vegetable soup?
Well, my lovely mother would be similar to you and she likes a traditional Christmas dinner and I'll certainly be taking her to Binky's. As I do most years.
Snobbery.
It was brilliant last year, and I don't work there, but it's a lovely restaurant, and it's affordable. It's not a top end. It's not. I don't want to.
And by the way, what is top end? It's top end now that you get this little kind of flies portion, something a fly of turkey, and they charge you £100 for it. Jim and Money Ray. Good morning, Jim. One of our colleagues here at the BBC. Go ahead, Jim.
Yeah, mate, I make you two or three gallon of vegetable soup and bring it into the office for you.
Thank you very much.
That's the solution.
Tell me the day, date and time.
What do you think of these snobs who I'm surrounded with on the Nolan team?
Mate, they're not snobs, they're colleagues. You need to realise that.
Thank you. Valued colleagues.
Yes, exactly.
The backbone of this team.
Is that the proper term?
Yes.
You're the front man of the show.
Yes.
But they're the backbone of it.
I totally agree with this man. And maybe the option should be we should all go to Fantasy Island for the Christmas do.
To my house.
Absolutely.
Mate, I cook for you.
Morning, John.
Stephen, I was just going to say the exact same thing. Why don't you invite the whole Nolan team down to Fantasy Island?
Definitely not.
In the back garden.
Definitely.
Charge them 345 quid a head.
But have you any idea what half of this lot are like?
I'm sure you've got them in one place.
No, they don't even wash when they come in the mornings. They're not coming onto my white carpet. Definitely not.
Throw them into the water or have a tent out the back.
Yes.
Best thing to do.
Put them in a tent.
345 quid a head.
Thank you, John. Wise up and find us somewhere with vegetable soup and turkey. That is your task for today. Is it accepted?
we'll give it a go. We'll try all means.
Thank you. Thanks, everyone. See you on 5 Live tonight, 10 o'clock. Enjoyed your company this week, and thank you very much for listening. See you tonight.
Listen again on BBC Sounds. Tweet @StephenNolan.